Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City, a journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today, with great pleasure, I'm going to introduce my guest, Alex Winder. Alex is a visiting assistant professor in Middle East Studies and also the director of undergrad studies at Brown University. Alex is a multitasking colleague and friend. In fact, he has been named also recently as the co-editor of the Jerusalem Quarterly. And he has a long list of publications, and we're going to talk about, obviously, most of his work around 1929, policing in Palestine, and particularly in Jerusalem. But first things first, Alex, welcome.
Thank you so much, Roberto. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast, and thank you for bringing this podcast to the world. There's been so many really interesting guests that you've had on. I hope I can reach some fraction of what the levels that they've already achieved.
Thank you so much for this compliment, which I take gladly. Let's get going, and obviously the first question that I'll ask all of my guests. Alex, what is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
So I was trying to think, in preparation, I know this is the kind of opening question for the podcast. So I was trying to think when I first went to Jerusalem, which would probably have been 2000 or 2001. My father actually worked for the US government, and in 2000, summer of 2000, he was posted to the US embassy. Which at that point was in Tel Aviv before, recently it was moved. So he and my mother moved to Tel Aviv in the summer of 2000. And of course, that was in many ways an inauspicious time to move, to Israel-Palestine. Of course, in October, the outbreak of the Second Intifada. And that, in a way, was what sparked my interest in Israel, Palestine, the politics and history of the situation. At that point, I was an undergraduate, so I would go to visit them during winter break, summer break. And so it would have been on one of those breaks that I first went to Jerusalem as a kind of tourist, as many people, I think, first encounter people who are not from this part of the world first encounter Jerusalem. Of course, at that time, it would have been an incredibly tense time. But I think, I was not necessarily aware of all the intricacies of the politics of Jerusalem at that point. From my perspective, it was sort of walking down these ancient streets and marveling at these kind of magnificent buildings. At that point, I remembered that there was no access for non-Muslims to the Haram al-Sharif. So I knew that, you know, that there was, to some degree, this was a place that was contested, that there were kind of politics built into it. But it was only kind of later that I really kind of took it upon myself to learn a bit more about what was happening in Jerusalem and kind of in Palestine, Israel more generally. Became kind of, you know, connected to Jerusalem really through, you know, taking classes, studying, researching. After I finished my undergraduate degree, I began working at the Journal of Palestine Studies, and that really kind of, you know, brought me in touch much more with people who were from Jerusalem, people who had very deep connections to Jerusalem, people who had written on Jerusalem. And then it took me probably about 10 years after graduating from my undergraduate degree to actually go back to Jerusalem, not to visit, you know, my parents, but to kind of be, you know, conducting research there. I did archival research in Jerusalem for about a year in 2013, 2014, living in Ramallah and commuting back and forth to the Israel State Archives, which were at that time in Tel Piot, before they kind of went completely online. And so that was also a very interesting relationship with Jerusalem, right? As a kind of commuter from Ramallah, taking the bus into Jerusalem, then taking the, you know, Bethlehem bus and getting off in Tel Piot, you know, really kind of making friends, becoming familiar with the city, but still being kind of removed from it in a certain way because I was living in Ramallah, and kind of associate it in many ways with, you know, Calandia checkpoint and to what degree is traffic going to be horrible or not, you know, how to manage this kind of the hours that you're stuck in line waiting, even as someone who has a U.S. passport and kind of is able to move much more easily than others, you know, it still kind of becomes this sort of thing that defines your relationship with the city in a lot of ways. And then recently I went back actually just in January 2020, kind of before the, you know, global pandemic really kind of shut down travel, with my partner Alia, and kind of it was interesting going back with her to kind of again visit it as a sort of tourist and to see it with new eyes in a way. It was her first time being there, and so again kind of seeing the major sites and kind of walking through, you know, the old city of Jerusalem with, you know, much more knowledge, but also kind of, again, kind of seeing it for the first time, as if for the first time, right, to kind of have that excitement and that kind of, and this was actually, it was the first time that I, that, you know, we went together to the Haram al-Sharif, and it was the first time I'd actually been there, which, you know, as someone who's studied, you know, Palestine and Jerusalem for many years, you know, it seemed strange in a way that I had not had that experience before, but that, you know, was a totally new experience and a really kind of amazing experience for me. So I think, you know, it's a relationship that's constantly, you know, evolving, and it's changed in many ways from kind of, you know, someone who's a kind of completely ignorant kind of tourist to someone who's kind of engaged and involved in academic questions, and then again as a kind of, you know, tourist to visit it again with that different perspective, and, you know, again the you mentioned Jerusalem Quarterly, so that's also been a huge part of my kind of connection to Jerusalem. It's so since being in Palestine in 2013, you know, working closely with Salim Tamari, and he kind of brought me to be a part of kind of a team that worked on this journal, Jerusalem Quarterly, which has, you know, been a really big part of my kind of education on Jerusalem, really, to kind of read the articles, to edit the articles, to kind of see the different ways that people have engaged Jerusalem, approached Jerusalem, through photography, through travel writing, through you know, archaeology, through history, ethnography, all these different ways of kind of seeing the city in different ways, seeing different parts of the city, becoming kind of more acquainted with parts of the city that are, you know, if you go as a tourist, you're not going to go to Kfar Aqab, you know, you're not going to go to Shafat Camp, you know, these different parts of the city that are, that have, you know, real importance and real meaning and kind of help open up the understanding of Jerusalem in different ways. You know, that's really been a huge kind of pillar in terms of my education and understanding of Jerusalem and my relationship to the city.
In 2000, I made my first trip to Palestine and Israel, and I remember I had the same opportunity to visit the Haram al-Sharif compound because that was right before the Second Intifada, and so, you know, there were less restrictions, and I remember the fascination. And yet that was not actually the moment I thought about working on Jerusalem, to be honest. So in a sense, I understand what you're saying is like, sometimes you go around, you explore, but then there are other reasons why people get, you know, into a, like in our case, like into an academic kind of job and research. But one thing that certainly we have in common is that at some point we came across the Jerusalem Quarterly. Now we are working together. Yes. But obviously, you met Salim, you met other people, you mentioned that you were also got a job for the, was that the Institute of Palestine Studies, correct?
Yeah, in Washington, D.C., the D.C. office working as a on the Journal of Palestine Studies.
And I started reading the Jerusalem Quarterly the moment I started my PhD. And of course, I needed some sources, and I found these amazing publications with all these different articles covering history, sociology, anthropology connected to Jerusalem. And so that became my main source for, you know, material. And now, as I mentioned at the very beginning, you have been recently named as one of the co-editors together with Dr. Lisa Taraki of the Jerusalem Quarterly. And so I'm going to take the chance here to ask if you can give us a sense of what is the Jerusalem Quarterly, what's the history of the journal, and what's the purpose of the journal?
That's a great question. And you know, the journal really, I think, came out of this, you know, the sense at the Institute for Palestine Studies, which is the kind of umbrella organization that publishes Journal of Palestine Studies and Majalat al-Dirsat al-Filastiniya, and also for a while, the French language, Revue d'Etudes, that Jerusalem itself was, and I think it also came out of this kind of, you know, post-Oslo moment feeling, and the timing of the Second Intifada as well, that this kind of place, Jerusalem, which has this kind of intense kind of symbolic significance for Palestinians, that was kind of, you know, viewed as this, you know, future capital of a Palestinian state, that was this kind of cultural and religious and you know, economic hub, you know, a major city for Palestinians. You know, that the place of Palestinians in it was becoming less and less secure, that it's, you know, this idea that it would be a kind of, you know, potential capital of a Palestinian state, that hope was kind of dimming or diminishing. And that what was happening on the ground in Jerusalem kind of really required kind of attention, and that a journal, a kind of, you know, originally it was called the Jerusalem Quarterly File, right? So a kind of a dossier every 3 months to update the situation in Jerusalem, which seemed to be kind of eroding significantly, was in order, that this was a significant issue in and of itself. And so I think that was the original kind of idea behind launching Jerusalem Quarterly. Of course, I think very quickly, you know, Salim Tamari, who is the kind of founding editor of it, you know, has such an amazing kind of range of interests and mind for Palestinians, social history, you know, photography, music, diaries, you know, all these different kind of facets of Jerusalem and Palestinian kind of history, that it became much more than a sort of quarterly update on what's happening in Jerusalem, right? It became a really kind of exciting place where different kinds, different facets of Jerusalem and Palestine more generally, these kinds of understudied or kind of marginal histories became, you know, were given light and were given a kind of platform for exploration. And I think, you know, the group of people that were involved, Rima Hamami, Penny Johnson, Sam Nassar, Nazmi Jobe, who you recently had on the podcast, you know, these are people with kind of really an interest in kind of the stuff of daily life, you know, whether it's kind of in the present, but also in the past, right? Not a kind of dry, you know, kind of history of Jerusalem or this kind of official historiography of Jerusalem, but kind of getting into the nooks and crannies, the kind of dirty parts of Jerusalem, the underbelly of the city, the ways in which it doesn't conform to certain kinds of ideas about what it should be. And I think it's really, you know, grown from this kind of original idea to being a place where, you know, that the city comes alive in so many different ways, and the different kind of issues that face the city are not just kind of on a diplomatic level or a political level, although of course those are kind of important and those are addressed, but kind of this on a social level, like how do people live in Jerusalem? How did people live in Jerusalem? What are the things that matter to them? Who are the people that were kind of on the margins or are on the margins, and what are their experiences of Jerusalem and of Palestine like? A few years, Bishara Dumani came on also with Salim as a co-editor, and I think this is also, you know, very much a vision that aligns with his of kind of Palestinian studies, thinking about all the different ways that Palestinians, you know, to try to not see Palestine or Palestinians as a monolith, as really kind of seeing it as a dynamic society that has that, you know, is not necessarily romanticized, right? That has, you know, its kind of elements that are perhaps, you know, don't fit kind of certain kind of romanticized images, whether it's from an Orientalist perspective or from a nationalist perspective, and that it's really that kind of social history, micro history, kind of plumbing the different depths of what people's lived experiences of Jerusalem and of Palestine and kind of the lived experience of Palestinians beyond Palestine and their connection to the land of Palestine and to Jerusalem as a city. How do you kind of really take into account the diversity, the dynamism, the kind of the ways in which these histories are not kind of flat or static, but really kind of open to a lot of different ways of interpretation and of exploration. And so I hope, you know, they've set a really high standard for Jerusalem Quarterly. As you say, you know, kind of reading it you're, there's so much really fascinating and kind of unexpected material in the journal, you know, over the last 20 years or so. It's you know, sometimes you'll run across something and you just, you know, it's like finding a kind of nugget in the archives, right? You know, and so that's a really kind of what I think is amazing about the journal, is that it has these kind of surprises in it, that you never are kind of 100% sure. It's not boring, you know. It's a really exciting journal, and part of that too is, you know, I think in a way it's an academic journal. There are academics who write for it. There are kind of research articles and things like that, but it's not only that. It's a journal that, you know, is close to the ground, that it wants to capture the voices of people living in Jerusalem. It you know, gives voice to, you know, younger scholars to people who are not scholars, but who are, you know, Jerusalemites, to people who are conducting oral histories and interviews, remembering their family, all these different dimensions. And it's, I think that's also reflected in it. It's open access, right? So anyone can go online and read any issue of the journal. It's all available in, on the website. And I think, you know, that reflects the kind of ethos of Jerusalem Quarterly, right? It's not kind of, again, kind of high above the fray and kind of looking down at Jerusalem. It's kind of in Jerusalem and of Jerusalem and with Jerusalem and for Jerusalem, right? It's you know, in a place where distributing paper copies of a journal and, you know, is not the easiest thing, right? If you're in the West Bank, if you're in Palestine, if you're, you know, wherever you might be, if you're a Palestinian in a refugee camp in Lebanon, you know, there's a kind of, you know, part of the goal, I think, in making it open access is to say, this is a journal for Palestinians, for everyone. And you don't have to be, you know, have a university library subscription. You don't even have to have a subscription to, you know, the paper journal itself. This is kind of, it's a popular journal in that sense of kind of the meaning of the word, you know, for the people. And so I hope that we can kind of maintain that. You know, I'm perhaps romanticizing it a little bit, but I do think that that's, you know, at least the kind of driving kind of vision behind it, that it has been this and it should continue to be this.
I must confess that one of my favorite articles, it was an article about the cats of Jerusalem. Mm. And I always wish there would be like someone else writing about them. Like, I think this was published probably around 10 years ago, but it really stuck with me. And it's like, oh, I wish someone else would engage with that aspect of the city. You know, they're fascinating animals as a cat lover, but right. Also they made me think about that, like, these cats can roam around the city freely. And literally they are the only ones who can just go across and, you know, just don't bother too much about artificial or even real borders that are set throughout the city. Alex, I wanted to ask you something about, again, the Jerusalem Quarterly, because I think this is an important aspect, not just of your work, but also of Jerusalem itself. You mentioned earlier that essentially the journal wants to be open to everyone because it's available on online for free. But also from my perspective, what I cherish of Jerusalem Quarterly is that it's intersectional in a sense that it's open to scholars from different backgrounds, regardless of their, you know, identity, whether they're Israeli, Palestinians, international. And that to me always made Jerusalem Quarterly a forum, a way to look at Jerusalem from multiple perspectives. And I was wondering what you make of this.
I mean, I think, you know, you kind of mentioned this in the question, but I do think in some ways it is a reflection of the city itself, right? I mean, you know, one of the things I remember living in Ramallah and kind of commuting into Jerusalem and then kind of coming into Jerusalem to socialize is also kind of, there are all these international organizations, there's, you know, the kind of religious institutions that bring people from all over the world. There's kind of people from, you know, Israelis, Palestinians, there's, you know, Armenians, you know, of longstanding kind of Armenians who are, or more recent kind of inhabitants of the city. There's that it's really, you know, kind of reducing Jerusalem to any one thing is impossible, I think, you know, and I think this is in many ways what Jerusalem Quarterly is kind of working against, right? The idea that Jerusalem is any kind of frozen as one particular thing, frozen as a symbol, or frozen as a holy city, or you know, that in many ways kind of approaching Jerusalem as the city that's made up of the people that live there, of the people who are invested in it, you know, emotionally, economically, politically, that kind of this approach to Jerusalem, I think, allows it kind of, and encourages kind of people with different kinds of connections, people with different kinds of perspectives, to be a part of a conversation about Jerusalem, to be a part of contributing to what we know about Jerusalem. And I think, you know, it's not to say that kind of anything and everything about Jerusalem, you know, will be published in Jerusalem Quarterly. I think, you know, there are some, that there is a kind of ethical commitment of those who are working on the journal to kind of, to not want the city to be an exclusive city, to not want the city to be a city that kind of pushes out its residents, to not want the city to be an oppressive city. So I think, you know, to that degree, like there are some kind of common sort of political commitments, but it's not rigidly kind of defined by, you know, what somebody's nationality is, or kind of how, you know, that, you know, is assumed to define their connection to Jerusalem, but rather kind of letting that connection to Jerusalem kind of speak for itself in the way people write about the city.
Your work focused for the most part on policing and crime during British Mandatory Palestine. I was wondering if you can give us a sense of that period of time, and particularly focusing on the city of Jerusalem. Sometimes people associate Jerusalem with its holiness, but Jerusalem is a regular city where crime and policing are part of the city. They're embedded in the social fabric of the city itself.
Absolutely. And you know, it was one of the kind of major, and it still is kind of one, a very highly policed city, right? It was kind of the headquarters for the British Mandate administration. And as a result of that, it was where the kind of central prison was. It was also a city that even before the British, right, had a kind of connection to the Ottoman administration. And part of that was a kind of security apparatus. And so, you know, one of the things I'm interested in terms of looking at kind of policing and crime, lawbreaking, is what it tells us about kind of the relationship between state and society, right? And so in the history of the British Mandate is one that becomes kind of increasingly repressive towards Palestinians in terms of the security apparatus. You see a kind of, you know, increase over time of the number of British police who are kind of called in, British military who are called in, especially during the 1936 to 39 revolt. But one of the things that I'm kind of actually more interested in is to think about how Palestinians who served in the police force under the British Mandate interacted with Palestinian communities during this period. You know, I think it produced a kind of tension, right, where, you know, police who are of a certain community are associated with a regime that's seen as antagonistic towards that community. During the revolt, for example, there was, you know, targeted attacks against policemen, many of them, you know, British police or kind of, you know, Jewish policemen, but quite a few assassinations, attacks on Palestinians and Arabs who were serving in the Mandate Arab police force. So that kind of, you know, that in that moment during the revolt itself, you can really see the kind of the heightened tensions within the Palestinian community itself. On the other hand, you know, for many Palestinians, it was a job, right? It was a stable, relatively well-paying government job. And so looking at, for example, at oral histories conducted with Palestinians who served in the police force, this is the kind of primary, you know, their primary understanding of what they were doing as policemen, right? They joined the police because, you know, they were in search of a job. And this actually became, in Jerusalem, it became an issue for kind of in terms of this kind of divide between urban and rural Palestinians and kind of along class lines, right? So you had kind of urban Palestinian Jerusalemites who saw kind of rural Palestinians who had been enlisted into the police force coming into the city and doing police work, right? And so, you know, there was kind of complaints that that, you know, what are these, what is this sort of riffraff doing, kind of telling us what to do, essentially? So you can see, and from the British perspective, they were always interested in making sure that people who were serving in the police, or for the most part, they were interested in making sure that people who were serving in the police weren't serving in their hometowns, right? That they weren't serving in the places that they had families, that they grew up, because they were concerned that that would be a kind of corrupting influence, or that they wouldn't be able to do their jobs objectively. So for that, from their perspective, they didn't want Jerusalemites policing other Jerusalemites. They wanted non-Jerusalemites policing Jerusalemites. So you had this kind of tension within the city, kind of, especially among elites, right? Kind of looking down at these policemen. On the other hand, Jerusalem is a city that's kind of expanding wildly in the Mandate period, right? And so there is kind of, with that, there's concerns about, you know, lawbreaking of all different kinds. So whether it's, you know, of course, the most common things are things like robbery, you know, breaking and entering, burglary, these kinds of things. And of course, kind of from the British perspective, the most concerning kinds of crime were those that were kind of the clashes between different communities in Jerusalem. So especially between, you know, Jews and Arabs, between Zionists and Palestinians, this kind of fear that Jerusalem as a city with, you know, both kind of large Jewish populations and large Muslim and Christian populations, but also with these kind of sites that were kind of contested and spaces that were contested and spaces that had kind of particular significance, that this was a kind of tinderbox. And this was always a concern for the British in terms of policing. And so in many ways, although the kind of most common kinds of crime, and if you look at kind of complaints and arrest registries and these kinds of things, the things that people are worried about on a day-to-day basis is whether someone, you know, broke into their house and stole something, you know, from their house, or whether, you know, they have a dispute with their neighbor over, you know, whether something needs repair, you know, on the boundary between the two houses, or whether there's a fight between two families, or whether, you know, someone is kind of, there's a place where people are getting drunk in the neighborhood, and it's kind of disrupting people's sleep, and or kind of people are worried that it's attracting the wrong kinds of crowd. All these are the kinds of things that people express concerns about. But of course, from the British perspective, politics was the most important thing, and making sure that suppress or otherwise kind of control the sort of political tensions in the city was the number one priority.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm not well versed into the contemporary police reports from Jerusalem, But I suspect there won't be much of a difference, that despite the fact that I'm sure there's plenty of, let's call it regular crime, but the focus, at least monitoring, particularly Israeli media, is often, more political in a sense. The attention is about, potential or attacks carried out by Palestinians. Like just a few days ago, a woman was killed in the old city because allegedly was trying to attack an Israeli police. So I guess that really didn't change much from the British period, where crime is some sort of obviously does exist, but is shadowed in the face of more sort of political tensions. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think, you can see also, I mean, part of it too is, and again, this kind of connects to my interest in, you know, Palestinians who served in the police force. There's also this sense, that you have a kind of foreign occupying force, or a kind of a sense that the police aren't connected to the communities in, they're not rooted in the communities, and that it feels like that there's always this kind of tension between, just looking at photographs from the Mandate period, right, of British policemen kind of in the old city, patrolling the old city, conducting searches in the old city, and looking at the present day, images and video of the kind of Israeli checkpoint at Damascus Gate, and kind of the way, the control of access to the city and things like this, that, it's in some ways a kind of, it reinforces itself, right? The more the focus is on political crime and kind of this idea of kind of politics rather than kind of quote unquote, everyday crime or normal crime, the more it also kind of produces this divide between, the state and the society and those things are kind of, and vice versa, right? This kind of divide between state and society. So the more that the British are feel that they can't really trust Palestinians to serve in the police, the more they kind of bring British soldiers or British policemen to kind of patrol in Jerusalem and elsewhere in Palestine, the more it kind of produces this situation where people don't view the police as anything more than a kind of the kind of coercive arm of the state, right? That it and that the policemen themselves don't have any real, knowledge of what's going on or connection to what's going on in communities. They're just there to produce a certain kind of, political order that's deeply unpopular. Right?
I feel like Michel Foucault would be very much interested in these case studies for perhaps rewriting his work about policing, crime and punishment. I wanted to ask you something about what you mentioned, this historical dimension. The British employed also Indians, Muslim Indians, obviously coming from, British-controlled India, in order to patrol certain locations around Jerusalem, given the fact that obviously, they relied on the sort of the religious identity of this individual. And I wonder if there's any connection with how the Israelis are relying on Druze in order to control, particularly the entrance to the Haram al-Sharif. I wonder if they're using the same sort of techniques. So they sort of use individuals who share identity traits, whether it's religious or ethnical, in order to patrol certain parts of Jerusalem.
I mean, I do think there's a certain kind of shared logic between kind of British colonial and Israeli ways of thinking about also kind of the kind of racial makeup of the police and this kind of, a certain kind of association of martial races. And I think, from the British perspective, this was kind of an empire-wide kind of way of thinking about who would make a good policeman, right? So you actually see this becoming an issue kind of time and again in among British colonial officials in Palestine or thinking about Palestine. Whenever there would be a kind of a kind of situation that would bring Palestine to the fore as a place where there were these kind of you know, communal tensions and political tensions. This question of, you know, who can we have police these, you know, Jewish and Arab populations that will kind of be able to serve as quote unquote neutral intermediaries, right? You know, or who will be able to kind of control these populations and has it kind of within them to be good policemen. So they look to Cyprus and you know, should we bring Cypriot policemen? You know, they're familiar with this kind of society where there's, you know, kind of religious divisions within society. There was a kind of question of bringing Armenians, of bringing Assyrians from Iraq. And of course, you know, the recruitment of Assyrians into the Iraqi levies became a kind of real issue in Iraq that kind of ultimately really alienated the Assyrians from Iraqi society and kind of led people to view them as kind of affiliated with kind of British colonialism kind of quite directly, right? Or kind of bringing certain groups from Africa, British colonial Africa or British kind of India to come police in Palestine. And of course, none of these really kind of bore fruit in any kind of serious way. But I do think it shows a logic. And I think, you know, the recruitment of Palestinian Christians, citizens of Israel, especially Druze, Palestinian Druze citizens of Israel into the police. There's a certain logic, not only I think about kind of trying to figure out who might be a kind of an effective intermediary or a kind of useful intermediary, but also I think, and there's another connection with kind of British colonial thinking, you know, in terms of cultivating kind of pliant minority groups within society that then kind of are reliant on the state for protection, that are reliant on the state for certain kinds of forms of patronage and in some ways kind of dividing society into these kind of groups that are then in some ways pitted against one another. And so I think the case of the Assyrian levies in Iraq is one that you know is troubling. And you know, speaking to friends and colleagues in the Druze community in inside Israel, you know, this is a concern that it kind of produces a kind of antagonism, right? Or reproduces an antagonism between, you know, Druze communities and other Palestinian communities, or it kind of makes a promise to Palestinian Christians that they can kind of attain a status within Israeli society that's above that of Palestinian Muslim citizens of Israel. And Rauda Kanana has also written a book called Surrounded, that's kind of a kind of present day ethnography looking at Palestinians inside inside Israel who kind of are negotiating these kinds of really difficult situations. And you know, it's hard to, you know, one can understand why the seeing this as an avenue to access for, you know, improvement of one's kind of social and economic circumstances for oneself, for one's family, is attractive, right? And this is, again, kind of getting back to the mandate era. This is what motivated Palestinians to serve in the police force then, right? It's seen as a kind of a way of, you know, personal and family and communal improvement. You know, people were able to, you know, access certain kinds of things through government service that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to. But of course, one can also understand why people found, why their, you know, communities might have been dissatisfied with that kind of arrangement, right? That it was not, did not mean that everyone in the community had access to certain things. It meant that, you know, the way to get that access was through kind of making a deal with the state to police, surveil, you know, engage in the practices of control and suppression of the political will of the majority population, right? So it's this kind of, it produces a certain kind of tension, and it And it is kind of the way kind of colonial ideas are transmitted from one place to another, and how kind of this idea of martial races, of you know policing which populations, which groups, which ethnicities, which religions are quote unquote good at policing, really kind of it's shared across colonial situations really everywhere you look.
I guess the old Roman Latin divided et impera, divide and rule, still very much the leading principle that the British left and the Israelis picked up.
Yeah, and you can, you know, on the one hand, I think part of it was a kind of an intentional idea of you know, there's a goal of dividing the population, and some of it was just this was the way the colonial way of seeing the population, right? You have to categorize people. You have to, you have to kind of make order out of what seems like chaos, right? When you have a colony to run. And so, you know, categorizing people by who's good, you know, in the most basic terms, right? Who is good and will support the government, and who is bad and needs to be controlled. This is the kind of most basic way of understanding the population. And then, you know, upon that, you overlay kind of understandings of race, of, you know, ethnicity, of religion, and but also of kind of, you know, in the case of Palestine and of the British, right, they would designate like which villages are good villages or bad villages, right? So this is a kind of, you know, very, like it's both very crude, but it also kind of you can see the logic behind it, that you have to kind of you have to know the country, and the best way to know it, or the most important thing to know, is whether a village is supportive of the government or not supportive of the government. And that becomes the kind of organizing principle. And why that is, what are the dynamics within the village that kind of produce an affinity towards, you know, cooperation with the state on certain kinds of matters or not, that kind of gets tossed in the background, and it becomes kind of essentialized, right? So that this is a good village or a bad village. This is, you know, this religion is troublesome and this one is cooperative. And this kind of, you know, really kind of binds the British into certain kinds of, you know, it really shapes their approach towards policing, but also towards all kinds of other things, and whether, you know, funding schools, whether it's building roads, all different, you know, kinds of ways in which the state tries to govern the population is shaped by this kind of very crude, like good or bad, you know, kind of like matrix of understanding.
Feels as like Jerusalem has always had, I mean, at least in the last century or so, like a large police presence. And yet, it doesn't feel like people talk much about it. It feels like it's part of the urban fabric, the urban environment. But the way you are talking about it feels very much as if the police has a solid control. And again, this was certainly true during the British. It's obviously true under the Israeli. Perhaps it was also possible under the Jordanians in East Jerusalem. But the reality is that it feels as if the police is a large, strong, and visible component of the urban fabric of Jerusalem.
Yeah, I would say, and that's, you know, I think it's purposeful. I think, again, you know, there's a symbolism in this strong police presence. For the British, it was part of establishing Jerusalem as kind of capital of the mandate, of the administrative center, of asserting British control over Jerusalem. I think for the Israelis, it's very much about the same, right? Asserting a kind of, not just a material control, but also a kind of symbolic presence in the city, that the people who are, you know, who you see, who are in uniform, who kind of have the trappings of the state literally on their bodies, right? That they are wearing uniforms issued by the state. That they're everywhere you go. That you see them. That they're omnipresent and quite visible. And that this you know, I think it shows an attempt to symbolically as well as materially kind of assert control in a city. But I think it's also, you know, can be looked at as, you know, evidence of certain kinds of anxieties, right? That there's an anxiety, you know, when you have an overwhelming police presence somewhere, it is an attempt to assert control, but it's also, it shows you that there's, that presence is necessary to assert that control, that the control is contested in fairly substantial ways, in the same way that if you look at, you know, protests in the US where there's, you know, huge police presence, that you know, on the one hand, it shows you that the state is not necessarily, you know, willing to accept certain kinds of protest or certain kinds of, you know, confrontations. But it also shows that there's a kind of anxiety about certain kinds of issues that can bring people onto the street, that there's an anxiety about changes in society, about, you know, political changes that kind of require the kind of re-imposition or the kind of symbolic, kind of overwhelming symbolic force, right? That really you don't necessarily need all these individuals in police uniforms, but that the state feels that it's important to show that it has absolute control, and in doing so, it shows that it's kind of nervous about not actually having that full control.
You also wrote about 1929, which is one of those tragic events, massacres, I like to call it, that mark the recent history of Jerusalem. Obviously, Jerusalem witnessed many similar events, but that has remained very much like a staple in the memory of the various communities of Jerusalem. And you wrote about sort of the religious boundaries that probably shaped Jerusalem as a result of 1929. I was wondering if you can give us a sense of what is 1929 and what happened as a result of that event.
So in 1929, there was basically what had been a kind of, you know, brewing contest over access to the western wall of the Haram al-Sharif, the Wailing Wall, al-Buraq, you know, called different things by different communities, that kind of disputes and tensions over what kind of access was allowed to that site, who had access to different parts of it. And it was kind of wrapped up in this question of the status quo, where essentially the Ottomans had established rules over which communities had access to which sites, and the British had kind of, you know, made it their priority to maintain those rules. At least they kind of vocally committed themselves to that. On the other hand, you had a Zionist movement that was kind of gaining strength and pushing against the status quo, right? Essentially saying that this status quo that was established under the Ottomans was not favorable to the Jewish community in Palestine, and that it was necessary to kind of rewrite the status quo to grant Jews greater access, that you know, and in some ways for certain kind of groups within the Zionist movement, especially the kind of more radical right, to kind of lay claims to ownership over particular kinds of religious sites, including the Western Wall, right? You know, there were disputes in the year prior to the outbreak of 1929, this kind of, and I should say kind of 1929, it was a number of different things, right? It was both the kind of popular uprising against British rule and kind of combined with attacks against kind of recently established Zionist colonies in Palestine, but it was also kind of combined with these kind of very, you know, serious, you know, violence within kind of older cities that had more kind of older established Jewish communities within them, including Jerusalem, including Safed, and including Hebron, that these places that had, you know, kind of Jewish communities that been there since before the advent of the Zionist movement, really, that these were also kind of places where you saw kind of significant acts of violence and kind of attacks by Palestinians against Jews. And kind of within all this, you had kind of very significant British security forces, reprisals and attacks against Palestinians as well. So it kind of combined all these different things within it. So in 1929, this dispute over the Western Wall essentially kind of came to a head, right? You had Zionist marches and demonstrations kind of, again, kind of seeking to assert control and ownership over this religious site. You had, you know, Palestinians kind of reacting and kind of seeking to, you know, challenge that assertion. And you just had a kind of outbreak of popular violence in many ways. And what I was interested in was how these boundaries worked in a certain way to maintain a stable social order before kind of, in many ways, before the advent of Zionism or before the kind of rise of Zionism in Palestine, how they became kind of flashpoints and kind of how the challenging of existing boundaries said something also about the changing ways that people understood communities to be organized, not as religious communities, but as national communities. And that it was that this kind of, you know, in some ways a transition or a transformation of an understanding that saw communities in Palestine as religious communities to one that saw them as national communities, you know, brought about the certain kinds of challenges to these boundaries that were meant to kind of in some ways divide communities, but also to kind of lay out the existing social order. And that the violence of 1929 kind of, that we can read it as, you know, this shift from a sort of religious, you know, community-based social order to a national community-based social order. And I also wanted to, in some ways, kind of challenge a notion or challenge romanticized images of kind of life before 1929, both kind of from Zionist and from Palestinian nationalist perspectives that sort of saw this as, or saw kind of life before 1929 or before the mandate as kind of one of sort of harmonious coexistence. And I wanted to kind of push a little bit deeper and say this, how is it that this coexistence worked? You know, in some ways it worked because there were clear boundaries between different communities. There were certain kinds of expectations about, you know, these communal boundaries. And by boundaries, I mean kind of physical boundaries, but also social and you know, the ways people interact and marry and these kinds of things. And that the attempt to kind of dissolve or rewrite these boundaries introduced by nationalism is kind of, is what produced this violence, not that, and in a way to kind of get away from this sort of like a placid ideal before this moment and then kind of violent chaos after it, and to kind of really kind of delve in and see how it is that the society worked before 1929 and what is it that changed that brought about this kind of moment of kind of spectacular violence.
I hope to have in the future two scholars, Rana Barakat and Hillel Cohen, to talk about 1929 and hear the different perspectives on these events, and which I found fascinating and still, you know, requiring probably a lot of work. There's so many intricacies, not just about the events, but also the legacy that they left with the population of Jerusalem, but at large in Palestine. Mm. I have one last question for you, Alex. Is there anything that I didn't ask, but you want to add?
Oh, there's so many things to talk about. Well, one thing I will say, that's a very good question. I'll say that one of the things that I think is useful in thinking about Jerusalem and in writing about Jerusalem is the question of sources. And I think, you know, this also gets to this question of 1929, but also of policing, also kind of Jerusalem Quarterly in general, and thinking about, you know, what are the sources that we're using to write the history of Jerusalem? What are the kind of perspectives that are given primacy, and which are the perspectives that kind of remain marginal? And what are the perspectives that we simply don't have access to, but would like to have access to? And how does their absence from the archive change our view of the city? And I think, you know, working with police documents is kind of really helps make this extremely clear, because the police have a very, you know, particular perspective on things, right? They view everyone as a potential criminal in some senses. And when they're kind of engaged with someone who is, you know, accused or believed to have committed a crime or to have broken the law, their goal is to gather all the evidence that proves that they did it and kind of put it into a narrative that makes sense. On the other hand, when you look at kind of court records, for example, on the other hand, everyone who is in the position of a defendant in court is trying to prove their innocence, whether or not they've, you know, broken the law or not. And so you're stuck in a situation where the interests of every party are kind of clear from the outset, right? No one goes into a court case trying to prove their own guilt, you know? And so the interesting thing then becomes less about whether or not, you know, this source is correct or this source is correct, but trying to kind of read between the lines and reading kind of what are the different, what's important to different people in this setting, trying to get to break out of this framework of like, was the crime committed or was it not committed? Was this the person that committed it or was it not the person that committed it? And I think, you know, that in a sense, kind of that the necessity of breaking out of the sort of master controlling narrative is one that we can apply more widely for Jerusalem, right? That there are these master narratives, that there are these controlling narratives. And at times it can feel like everything about the city, everything that takes place in the city has to kind of be worked into one controlling narrative or another. But that the important thing is that you know, we don't have to let those controlling narratives control us, and that really we have a much better picture of Palestine, of Jerusalem, of Israel, if we don't allow those controlling narratives to be the only thing that frames our understanding of and the way that we absorb information, the way we read texts, the way we read sources, and that kind of coming at them with a more open perspective and a willingness to kind of not let those master narratives be the be all and end all really gives us a much richer, a much more vibrant, a more colorful, a more energetic and dynamic experience of the city. And so that's, I guess I'll leave with that.
This was Alex Winder, visiting assistant professor in Middle East Studies at Brown University and co-editor of Jerusalem Quarterly. Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberto.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others on social media or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Jerusalem Unplugged. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.